Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation cure master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at Surrey Farms. .com or virginiatraditions.com.
Welcome to this edition of The Main Course. It is a great honor for my show and for the entire Heritage Radio Network to have Michael Pollan on. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks, Patrick. Good to be here.
You're a mentor of mine and just about everyone else in the sustainable food world. And now you are an author of a new book. It's a new edition of Food Rules, an Eater's Manual, featuring even more rules. It's published by Penguin Press with beautiful illustrations by Myra Kalman. Michael Pollan's Food Rules began with this hunch that the wisdom of our grandparents might have more helpful things to say about how to eat well than the recommendations of science or industry or government. Food Rules provided simple, time-tested rules to eat and live by. It shot to number one on the New York Times bestseller list and sparked a remarkable national dialogue about how to best eat for health and pleasure. So let's talk about some of these new rules. I selected some of them. Eat close to the earth. And does that mean eating local?
You know, it tends to, but not necessarily. I mean, eating close to the earth is really try to shorten your food chain to the point where you have a pretty good idea where your food came from, where it was grown, and who produced it. In general, when you do that, you're not going to be eating processed food. Mm-hmm. And you're going to eat. You're probably going to be eating in season as well. And there are a lot of reasons to do that. Some are environmental. Some are social, supporting your local community, and some probably connect to health. A shorter food chain is fresher food and really reflects the environment you live in and the time you live in. So although we don't have proof of that, my guess is it's healthier to eat that way as well.
Now this one, I hope you have no proof on this because this is bad for me. Milk is a food, not a beverage. And I pound a glass of milk every night, and Anne is always like, you shouldn't do that. So tell us about that food rule.
Well, you know, it's funny. We're the only species that gets serious nutrition from liquids after weaning. Most mammals stop drinking milk and get all their calories from solid food after they wean. We drink milk, we drink alcohol, we drink orange juice, we drink all sorts of, and soda, notably. We get a lot of calories in a liquid form. And there's research to suggest that's not the best way to get them, because when you take your calories in liquid form, you don't get the right kind of signals telling you you're full. Mm-hmm. People can always drink a soda, even though they're getting, you know, hundreds or thousands of calories, and they don't feel full. The satiety signals don't work quite the same way. So in general, we should, you know, take as many of our calories in solid form as we can. Milk as a food has, I think, you know, it's fine, but it, like orange juice, it's been kind of oversold as the, you know, the essence of health. The marketing has been so clever. I mean, To look at the milk marketing, you would think, you know, it would be irresponsible to bring up a child without giving it, you know, 16 ounces of milk every day, as if it wouldn't have any bones, you know, when it grew up. But in fact, there are many other ways to get calcium in your diet other than milk, like greens, for example, spinach and things like that. So the whole idea that milk is indispensable to a healthy existence is dubious. But, you know, I like a glass of milk, too.
Serve vegetables first? That was interesting, because usually it's a side, right, with the main course.
Yeah, well, when you're serving, you know, look, we're all eating too much meat in America. I mean, we eat 9 ounces of meat per person per day. And if you eat meat, you're making up for the vegetarians who aren't eating any. So a lot of us are eating a lot more than 9 ounces. The problem with that is, well, there's an environmental problem. The world can't support a population of 7 billion eating that much meat. There just isn't enough land to grow the feed for it. There's nothing wrong with eating meat. I eat meat. I try not to eat it every day. And I think the key is to kind of put it back in its place as an element in the meal and not this giant centerpiece of the plate. So I find if you're serving yourself, we typically put the meat on first, and then we surround it with vegetables. If you serve yourself vegetables first, you will invariably take more vegetables and then have less room for meat. And that serves, I think, several goals. So that's how I kind of load my plate, is go with the vegetables first.
Now, I wanted to ask you one more rule, although this rule, I like the way it was written. If you're not hungry enough to eat an apple, then you're probably not hungry. And I thought that was great, greatly phrased. But tell us about this one. Don't become a short order cook.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of us are our kids basically turn us into short order cooks, and they want what they want when they want it. And the habit of eating what is served is in trouble in America, and we're all taking kind of a restaurant approach to the meal, and that's not such a good thing. I mean, I think there's a real virtue in people sharing the same food at the same time. It kind of puts everybody on the same emotional page or psychological page. And also, if you cater to your kids, you're just going to get pickier and pickier eaters. And, you know, I say this having learned by screwing it up. I mean, I had a very picky eater who we custom cooked to in various ways, and I realized it was probably a mistake. But when you're getting exactly what you want, when you get what you ordered, you will eat more. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you eat what is served, you're more likely to eat a reasonable amount. So in general, the ideal, I think, is to make one thing for everybody, and then it's kind of take it or leave it. Mm-hmm. And that the whole food industry is trying to encourage us in another direction, though. You know, you go to the supermarket, and they have home meal replacements, as they call them in the industry, for every member of the family. You know, you can get the vegan entree for the teenage girl who's experimenting with that dietary pattern, and then you can get the manhandler for the father with a pound of meat in it, and then you can get the Weight Watchers for the woman if that's what she wants, and then the frozen pizza for the boy. So they're trying to divide us into market segments and thereby get us to eat more food. So I say, like, let's share.
Well, very interesting. Well, we have got tons of questions. I emailed all the radio hosts. Hey, we have Michael coming on. You know, what questions should we be asking him? So we're about to get to that. But your books are such Bibles. I just want to ask you, in under a minute almost, your books are such Bibles to the sustainable food world. And by the way, what do you call that world? Is there a way of calling that entire thing that is good, clean, and fair as Carlo calls it for slow food? But I mean,
slow food is a terrific label for what we're talking about, because it does have many of the values in that one word. I mean, that the food is justly produced, that it's sustainably produced, and that, you know, that everybody involved in that food chain is being treated fairly, including the animals and the plants and the bacteria. I think that that's a pretty good way to look at it. I use the word sustainable sometimes, but that word is in danger of being hijacked. Mm-hmm. Monsanto, believes they're doing very sustainable work, and I don't think that that's true.
Right.
So
slow food.
No perfect
that's a
word,
good good word. Slow food. So just to, before we get to these questions, in defense of food, an eater's manifesto, which millions of students and Americans and people around the world have read, the result is what you call an American paradox. The more we worry about nutrition, the less healthy we seem to become. Can you just distill that for us and what the kind of thesis of that book was?
Yeah, I mean, basically, we've been obsessing about nutrients and getting the right nutrients and avoiding the wrong nutrients for decades in this country. And as it happens, that obsession coincides with the obesity epidemic. Worrying too much about food isn't good for your health either, and especially when you end up worrying about the wrong thing, which has often been the case because the science has changed and the science sometimes gets it wrong. The problem is that the anxiety about food that's kind of fostered by, you know, changing science and industry using, you know, the latest science to market their foods, it just leads to people losing focus on things like eating a meal. And as soon as you start thinking in terms of nutrients, people start binging on the good nutrients, even as they're avoiding the bad nutrients. So, for example, when we demonized fat, you know, with the whole low-fat craze, people binged on carbohydrates. So, you know, I'm kind of suggesting people try to cultivate a more relaxed attitude toward food. And as long as they're eating real food and they're doing it at meals, which is a very important institution that's in trouble, and they, you know, as I say, eat food, not too much, mostly plants, they don't have to worry about nutrients, and they don't have to worry about counting calories.
That was a big part of the omnivore's dilemma, right? Eat mostly plants and basically what we should be having for dinner.
Yeah, and which is not to demonize meat either. I mean, there, I think there is a place for meat if you like it in a healthy diet.
Well, thanks for saying that, because we would have had to edit all this interview out.
I know. You're in the meat business, right? I'm being careful.
Now, in The Botany of Desire, you know, in telling the stories of four familiar species, you illustrate how plants have evolved to satisfy mankind's most basic yearnings. And just as we benefited from these plants, we've also done well by them. And so you ask the question, you know, who's really domesticating whom? So will those very plants betray us if we continue treating the planet like we do?
I don't know if the plants are going to betray us, but, you know, some other species may betray us. I mean, the microbes are doing some funky things to us these days. You know, we also co-evolved with bacteria and fungi, especially the ones that are in our bodies that we, you know, we share our bodies with. And some of those have turned kind of nasty as a result of, you know, overuse of antibiotics and you know, eating a diet that isn't good for them either. I think one of the surprising things we're learning is that, you know, the fast food diet that we know is bad for our health turns out to be bad for the microbes' health, too, in our bodies. And when that happens, they act up sometimes. And there's... you know, we have to keep them in mind, too, when we're eating,
sure.
Which is a good argument for eating fermented foods and more plant foods, because they really like fiber, those bugs. So, you know, we are in this deep co-evolutionary relationship with these other species, and we have to think about their interests as well as our own.
For sure. So we asked our Heritage Radio Network hosts and partners to help us by submitting questions for Michael. So we'll just start with a few. Katie Kiefer, the host of Straight No Chaser, which airs Sundays at 1. It's a program that explores policies, professionals, and performance of the food industry in the 21st century. She asks, given the prediction of a population of 9 billion, what systems does Michael suppose will be able to produce enough food if we abandon industrial-scale farming?
Well, you know, that's another way of putting this question. Can you feed the world sustainably if the world population is going up to 9 billion? The honest answer is we don't know. But a couple of things we do know that are helpful in thinking through that problem. First is the industrial system is not succeeding in feeding 7 billion people, what we have now, more or less. It is, you know, there are a million people who are going to bed hungry in this world, and we have plenty of food. So the issue is not simply a matter of yield or quantity of food. You know, how the food is distributed, who has the ability to command the food, is as just as important as how many acres of, how many bushels of corn you can get off an acre of land. I would also add that there is that there are some recent studies that strongly suggest that sustainable agriculture could feed a population of 9 billion. You know, most of the world is growing food at very low yields right now, and that if they could, if Africa, for example, could simply bring yields up to where organic agriculture is in the United States or Europe, there would be a, you know, more food by a order of magnitude. The limiting factors, I think, on, I mean, I have seen small farms that are far more productive than industrial farms. They tend, however, to be labor intensive, and I think the real limiting factor is not what the land can do. In a small space or a large space, it's the limiting factor is do we have enough farmers on the land? And that's where I think the developing world potentially has an edge. I actually think that the really creative multicultural, polycultural, sustainable farms are better suited in some ways to Africa or to India, because there still are more people on the land than they are to America. You know, we only have 1.5 million farmers. China still has 700 million farmers. So I think there are ways to do it. The other point I would make is that there's a lot of play in the system we have now. I mean, meat eating is one example. I mean, half the grain we grow is going to feed animals. So if we cut down on meat eating, we could feed a lot more people on current yields. And lastly, we're wasting a lot of food. We're wasting about 25% of the food we grow right now. It's wasted at every level, beginning on the farm and going right to your, you know, what's in your refrigerator right now. So there are ways we could use the food we're already growing to feed a lot more people than we are.
Yeah, Erica Wides has a show called Chef Smarty Pants, and I think that's what her show is called. She's changed the name a couple of times, but she's had some statistic like 20% of all turkey meat is thrown away. But yeah, it's a great point.
Amazing.
Well, Linda,
it is. Waste is one of the, you know, stories we don't talk about in food that much. But
we'll have to have you
back. Just look at the dumpsters outside of grocery stores, and you'd be amazed at what's in there.
So Linda Palacio, host of Taste of the Past, that airs Thursdays at 12, and she takes us on a weekly journey through culinary history. She says, you've said, Michael, that as a society we aren't really cooking anymore, and we acknowledge that there are more food choices than ever. What effects has this had on our population's health?
Well, I think that the gradual decline and collapse of cooking as something that happens most days in most people's houses has had a profound effect on our health. I mean, that's, you know, people are eating fast food, and we know what fast food does to people. Basically, when you outsource the cooking of your food to corporations, your health suffers because they tend to cook with far too much salt, fat, and sugar. Because those are really cheap ingredients that turn us on, and they're going to use as much of them as they can to sell food that doesn't cost them much to produce. As soon, you know, and we have research that shows that there is a correlation between whether you cook at home and the quality of your diet. Doesn't matter what you're cooking. You can cook your own junk food, and it's going to be better than the junk food you would buy. So I think it's a really important part of the equation, and I also think that, you know, local food and CSAs and farmers markets, you know, these great new institutions that are growing like crazy, the limiting factor, I think, is going to be that people don't cook. You need to be able to cook to take full advantage of a local food system. So I think it's really important. I also think it has important social implications, too. We know families that enjoy a family dinner are healthy by many other measures, including mental health, including, you know, kids' drug use and performance in school. All these things go together. The meal, the family meal, is one of the great civilizing and socializing institutions of our society. And we're treating it cavalierly. I mean, people are moving away from meals to grazing on snacks. You know, something like 60% of the breakfast cereal is no longer eaten at breakfast. It's kids are eating it, and college kids are eating it all day long.
Yeah. Well, very interesting. I mean, talking about that, the Heritage Meat Shop, which is a stall at the Essex Street Market, a public market on Essex and Delancey, they ask, what role does famine play in American discourse about food?
Well, not much of one, I don't think.
Because we used to almost starve. I mean, you know, that back in the Great Depression and stuff, people were starving,
right? People were concerned about food, and it's one of the reasons I think that we celebrate abundance to the extent we do, and that we, you know, put that 16-ounce steak on our plates. We're kind of like reminding ourselves what we have and that we no longer have to worry about food. So it may be that there's kind of a pendulum swing and that the fear of hunger has encouraged people to overeat and you know, go crazy in purchasing food. I mean, there was also, you know, when I grew up, you know, your mother would say, finish what's on your plate because people are starving in Korea or wherever, you know, and in retrospect, that was kind of a crazy idea, but a lot of us heard it, and we were socialized to, in a way, eat too much because of the threat of famine somewhere else. I mean, I think you know, forcing your kids to finish what's on their plate is probably not such a good idea. I think we should be learning how to leave something on our plate symbolically and in order to kind of get control of our appetite.
So this question is from me. Is it classist to say that certain foods are elitist, presuming that poor people should not know the truth about taste and quality and strive for it like they do an iPhone or clothing? If no one protests in front of an Armani for producing an expensive version of clothing, why does it happen with food?
It's a great question, Patrick. I don't know why. I think that we kind of accept this hierarchy of taste everywhere but food. You don't, you know, cars too. People don't complain about elitist cars. But around food, we do. And it may be because we do feel that there is a right to good food at some deep level. And there is an ethic of sharing built into food that's not built into clothing or cars or other things. I'm not sure. But it's also just a cudgel used to beat up the food movement. And that there are a lot of people coming mostly from industrial food who, and, you know, the legions of right-wing media, want to discredit the food movement. And since good food tends to be more expensive than crappy food, it has allowed the purveyors of industrial food to assume kind of a populist stance. But you have to wonder, when companies the size of McDonald's are carrying the populist banner, you know, is that really a meaningful populism? I don't think so. It's just cheap food, or it's food with, you know, where you don't really pay the full cost of the food. So I think we should be sensitive to charges of elitism, and people are, and they're working very hard to democratize the food movement. I think we need to extend the benefits and the wonderful tastes of good food to everybody, but that's going to take social change at a very high level. I mean, there's also this assumption that the food movement can solve all the class problems of our society, and that's probably too big a charge for the food movement. I mean, the reason that many poor people can only afford poor food, I mean, poor quality food, is because we're not paying people enough money to be able to afford to pay the real cost of food. And so cheap food, which is to say dishonestly priced food, is kind of built into our economy now. I mean, we've had cheap food, since the 70s, say, and that coincides with the collapse of wages in this country. So in other words, the cheapening of our food has subsidized the fall in wages. And so we're not going to be able to get out of this until we figure out a way to put enough money in people's wallet, so they can afford better food.
So
people have become dependent on cheap food.
This, I thought, was a very interesting question. Chris Howell, he's a sponsor. He's the winemaker of Cane Vineyard in Napa Valley. He asks, from reporting to instructing, from news page to editorial page, are you still a journalist?
Good question. Very good question. I think I am still a journalist, and I also am an advocate. I think it's possible to write advocacy journalism. In other words, journalism that is doesn't pretend to being impartial, but does strive to be fair. And that even though you can write a piece that is taking a strong position on, say, something like genetically modified food, there's a way to write that piece that is real journalism. That is based on information that you're learning, not preconceptions, that is based on being fair to other points of view. But it's something I struggle with all the time, because I am a journalist and I also am an advocate. There are certain kinds of stories that I would only write on the op-ed page that are, you know, pure opinion. But I think I can still do journalism that honors the really important ethical principles of the field, which I teach. You know, I'm a journalism teacher too,
so
I better be able to do it.
Yeah, exactly. We're getting down to our final couple questions, but thank you so much. This is really such a great interview. Aaron Fairbanks, Farm Report, airs on Thursdays. Does it matter who we vote for president when it comes to this issue of food and sustainability and the movement that we all believe in? are we vote? Are we having any act, you know, effect
well,
with that vote?
Yes and no. I mean, it's been, this administration has, in some ways, been very disappointing on food issues. Obama's really dropped the ball on some important things. The last is the GIPSA rules that the USDA, that was passed by Congress, and, you know, that was supposed to improve the ability of small farmers to deal with large meat packers. And the USDA wrote some really strong rules, and after some protests by the meat industry, the government caved, you know, basically backed down and published some very lame rules. Over and over again, we've seen that on genetically modified foods. There have been some good things, too. There's some good people at USDA. The Know Your Farmer campaign, I think, has been very good in encouraging local food systems. And the bright light, really, has been Michelle Obama. I mean, she has taken up this issue and has done a lot to raise the profile of good food and gardening and organic food, farmers market food. So I think she's done a lot of good. I wish her husband would back her up a little more strongly with policy. What I think is happening, though, is that Michelle Obama is gradually building a constituency that will make it possible to have some real, policy reforms going down the line.
It looks good.
There's a lot more to be done. Does it matter who you vote for? Yeah. I mean, I think you're better off. I think we're still better off with Obama than any of the Republicans. I haven't heard any of them say anything very good about food, although I saw Ron Paul will legalize raw milk. I don't know what you think about that, but that's the, you know, food has not been a big feature in the Republican debates.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're better off with a Democrat in the White House, and it's up to us to put the heat on him so he does the right thing. I mean, both parties are in the pocket of big food, let's face it. But I think we have more chance to push them with the Democrat in the White House, and especially with one married to Michelle Obama.
For sure. Well, last question. Michael Harlan Turkle, host of The Food Scene, Tuesdays at 3. He explores the entwined worlds of food and art by talking to artists and chefs. He really loves you, Michael, and he wants to know who else should he read? Like, whose rules do you follow? I mean, if you were to name a couple of writers or
sure,
you know, what, like, for someone who's read all your books, where should they go next? Old school people, maybe, who are your mentors?
Yeah, well, there's a whole bunch of writers. I mean, you know, this is this conversation we're having. A lot of the things I've been writing, you know, I didn't dream this stuff up. I mean, I have my own influences. Wendell Berry was a very important influence of mine. He did a lot of brilliant writing on food and the connections between agriculture and politics and what we eat and what we grow. So definitely his books. Also in the 70s, though, Francis Moore LePay, Diet for a Small Planet. That was a real breakthrough book, you know, connecting the dots between our meat eating and hunger and environmental concerns. Someone who's less well known that I think is has been one of my greatest teachers is Joan Gussow.
Oh yeah,
Gussow.
She's been a guest on Main Course a few times.
Well, she is one of the visionaries, and I've learned so much from her. And she's just so common sense. And you know, she's a nutritionist, and she's one of the people I still go to when I've got a question about these issues. And
she's almost like a survivalist. I mean, she really was.
She grows her own food, yeah. And she walks the talk. And so she's an important person. Marion Nessel, too, I learn a lot from, and I consult her all the time. There's an Eric Schlosser, too. I think his work has been really, really important on, mm-hmm. on meat in particular and farm workers. And he's done a good job of keeping some focus on that. That's the great forgotten issue in so much of the food movement, mm-hmm. are the people who are picking the food and working in the factories who we don't pay nearly enough attention to.
Well, what an honor, Michael. Thank you so much. You get a free pizza if you come in studio. So next
deal.
Time you're in New York,
you didn't
I
tell
hope
me that.
You,
okay. Well, next come. Time I will do this in studio.
Thank you so much. It's a real honor, and have a great weekend.
Thank you so much, Patrick.
Thanks, Michael.
Wow, we're back. What a great interview with Michael Pollan. Wow, it was a real honor for the station, for the main course, for everybody. So thank you, Michael, for coming on. And so we have in studio now Robert Sterling, who's come in. He's chef and owner of Hominy Grill in the South, which is one of the few Southern restaurants that Heritage Foods deals with. And we were just going to kind of talk about the Michael Pollan interview because we were just listening to it. And what did you think of it, Robert?
I thought it was great. And, you know, really fascinating man. I'm sure he was enjoyed those questions that you had for him. They were quite around the dial.
Did you agree with everything he said?
Yeah, I think so. You know, he seems to sum up a lot of these, you know, subjects all where they intersect and, you know, what kind of not to agree with on some levels.
Now, I mean, he brought up some interesting things. The for instance, like cooking at a restaurant, you know, eating out can never be as good as eating at home. Did you agree with that? I mean, not as good tasty, I meant as nutritious.
I definitely think he's right about that. You know, any, you know, restaurant processes food just like any, you know, big, you know, industrial food complex does. And, you know, restaurants, their main goal is to sell you what you want to eat, not what is good for you.
Right. But, I mean, do you put unhealthy things into your food? I mean, an unhealthy amount of stuff?
I don't, but, you know, I generally, when I cook in the restaurant, I'm cooking for a lot of people, so if I drop a pound of butter in there or a few handfuls of salt, you know, I'm thinking, you know, that's going to spread a long way, and you know, the scale is so much different. You know, when you're dumping unhealthy amounts of stuff at a time, mm-hmm. just due to the amounts you're working with.
Because, I mean, you're a rich kind of food cuisine anyway at Hominy, right? I mean, it's biscuits, it's cured ham, it's Southern food, right? Or
yeah, certainly a lot of the hallmarks of Southern food are you know, the pork and the butter and, you know, all those, you know, bleached flour and all that kind of stuff is you know, traditionally in there, you know, the way we work, you know, in Hominy, we try to blend that. It's also a diet that's really agrarian and very strong in vegetables. And, you know, the meat that was traditionally used was simmered in a pot for a long time. And then that was doled out to everybody in the family, and everybody got a little taste. It was their way of sharing what otherwise may have been only a few mouthfuls of pork, you know?
And I think, Patrick, the interesting distinction that Michael made was, you know, what he said is when you outsource the cooking of your food to corporations, your health suffers.
Right.
And I'm guessing he wouldn't be so much against, you know, smaller restaurants as he would a P.F. Chang's or a TGI Fridays where it's kind of corporatized.
Fast food, because you can eat slow food at good restaurants, but like, you know, Robert says it's still, you know, you still put a pound of butter in something, you know, and, you know, it's interesting because you want people really to get a bang for their buck, a real taste epiphany, and things like butter and salt help that. But, no, it's a good point. Now, what about chef's responsibilities? I mean, is there, what responsibility do you feel as a chef? I mean, down south or just in general?
Well, I think, you know, Michael Pollan was right in saying that, you know, most people don't cook at home, and we haven't done it in a couple generations. You know, when I was a kid growing up, the kitchen work was portrayed in advertising as drudgery, and women were emancipated from that kitchen, and they kind of stopped handing down recipes to their daughters, and their daughters now don't have that knowledge to pass on to the cooks. You know, they, you know, all our cooking knowledge comes from watching the Food Channel, and they are marketing you something else next week. And the, you know, we eat out in restaurants, and chefs need to respect those traditions and work within them and try and pass that down in some ways just keep it a part of our lives.
Mm-hmm. And what about his old elitist argument? I mean, what's the average food cost at Hominy Grill and at restaurants like it? And, you know, is it an elitist thing? I mean, how do you deal with that whole argument through your restaurant?
Hominy is definitely an elitist thing.
It is?
Not so much price point, but, you know, are you willing to work to get in there? We stay pretty busy, and you know, Charleston's a big tourist town, and, you know, people don't want to wait in line for a sandwich every day for their lunch. So you need to work at that, and that cuts out a lot of people who don't have the time or are willing to work at it.
But what about price? I mean, are people clamoring for cheap food down south? I mean, is it any different, or is there maybe some more appreciation? Because, I mean, you were talking about how, just before the show started, how the South was really the gastronomic center of America for a long time. I mean, they almost wanted America to be like London, and so they imported stuff to make it be like that.
Yeah, you know, definitely the more interesting food in our past has been the elitist food that you know, they would import and would influence the way they cooked. The South today is definitely elitist in their food. In a town like Charleston, it's an expensive restaurant culture. Mm-hmm. That the average person can't really afford to, you know, maybe spend that much money on a dinner a couple times a year. And yet that market has been strong and booming, mm-hmm. through the economy of the last few years. It's the lower mid-range markets, the restaurants that are out clustered around the malls, those are the places that are being hurt in this economy. And that's the entry level eating out, you know, that you know, starting a separation, you know, class separation with these people who just can't afford to eat out anymore.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is the diet of the South? I mean, is there a general diet? I mean, is it meat heavy? Is everyone eating country ham for breakfast and dinner? I mean, is it mostly fruit and vegetable based? I mean, how would you define, you know, Southern cuisine? I mean, what? Because you read a lot about the South. I mean, you were just talking some history, which I'd love for you to tell our listeners about, because it's a pretty interesting trajectory.
Well, the Southern food, you know, Southerners are pretty. It's a pretty agrarian society, and you know, they did not experience quite the rise of the middle class that the Northeast did, due to maybe losing the Civil War and setting, you know, industrialization back a little while, took a little longer. So, you know, people relied on their gardens and had better diets for it, you know, in the last half of the last century. In surveys, consistently rural Southerners, lower classes, had the best diets because they couldn't afford the newer, you know, niceties of processed food that were showing up in the grocery stores, in the marketplace. And they maintained that until they became wealthy enough to start eating fast food. And now I think they have the worst diet of any segment of our population, just because they're way behind the curve on our elitist food ideas.
So what was the history of the restaurant in the South? I mean, were people always going to pubs like they were, for instance, in New York or in Boston? You know, people would go and get a, I don't know, some type of potato dish or something like that. I mean, how were people eating in the South when they would go out? I mean, what was the special occasion spot? And, you know, were there certain historic restaurants that people still talk about, like Commander's Palace, for instance, in New Orleans?
Yeah, South Carolina really doesn't have any of those old houses like that. And, you know, New Orleans has such great traditions of restaurants that have been around for hundreds of years. It seems like Charleston and the Low Country, you know, wealthy planters, they all had huge plantations. And when people traveled, they'd stay at the plantations. They would get, you know, introductions through mutual friends, and then they were fed out of the home, and home cooking has been the main tradition. The restaurants have developed there in the last few years are not tied to that at all. Mm-hmm. There was also all the entertaining that went on in the mansions during the social season with the balls and but that was done by a battery of cooks.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, home cooks. Well, we're going to take a brief break, and then we're going to have Robert back. And we are broadcasting out of Roberta's. We're sponsored by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, cured hams made out of Surrey, Virginia. We'll be right back. So we are back with Robert Sterling, the chef of and owner of a very historic restaurant, Hominy Grill. So let's talk about Michael Pollan. Did really a great interview with us, and he talked about shortening the food chain. What does that mean to you?
Well, it was interesting because he didn't, he mentioned local and how they were very different things, and I really appreciate that. Just, there's so much kind of banging the local drum and comparing, the miles and all that stuff to each other. But I've always felt that, my food chain in South Carolina started in Florida and went up the East Coast, and that I felt like local meant East Coast. There's certain marketing, getting things to market system that it has been set up, that when those first strawberries hit in Florida, I want to get them. And if they're going to come up on a flatbed truck in a few hours, then that's close enough to local for me.
Yeah.
It's when they have to be flown in from California that I'm start thinking, okay, this isn't really local anymore. And they're not really tasting that great. So,
well, it's interesting. I mean, Carlo Petrini always taught me, when he would go out to dinner, he was always wanting the best thing. Best food from wherever it was. So he would never want to go and eat a third-rate anchovy or a second-rate eggplant. He was always like, we need the best. Or he's like, do you know there's a guy 300 miles that way that makes an eggplant 500 times better? He would want to introduce the two, but, he would never reward anything for a distance. He would reward the gastronomic quality of a food, even if it didn't come from backyard. Now, what about the real cost of food? That's a real interesting topic. And, what's that mean to you through the lens of, Hominy Grill and your life? Because true cost, real cost, false costs, what does it all mean?
Well, I assume a lot of it has to do with the subsidies that the government supplies. South Carolina, the agricultural money goes in a lot of traditional patterns. I know my brother has a restaurant in North Carolina, and if I go up into the Asheville area, that state spends its money very differently in how it supports farmers in small agro business and small even food businesses that start up there. There's a lot of help. There's a lot of state help. There's a lot of federal help that is directed to them, and it's much better than in South Carolina.
Right. Now, you have a lot of small farms there, right? As well as massive kind of Purdue-type companies, right?
there's a lot of small farmers still in South Carolina. They farm very traditionally, and by that I mean maybe in the last 60 years, 70 years that way. Their new ideals of farming that are coming out now aren't filtering into South Carolina, especially along the coast where we are. The problem is overdevelopment there, and mm-hmm. the land values are just too insanely high. Hmm. And we're in a subtropical, semi-subtropical zone in Charleston, so the growing seasons are very new to people.
Hmm. So give us your website. It's hominygrill.com.
Hominygrill.com.
And you are in the heart of Charleston?
I am in downtown Charleston, yes.
And what can people expect if they go to the city of Charleston besides going to Hominy Grill? I mean, what else? Why is it a reason to go down there and visit?
It's a beautiful city, and consistently ranks high in places to visit and places to move to. There's a strong arts movement, and you're on the coast. It's beautiful there for water sports. There's mm-hmm. a vibrant food community that has grown rapidly there.
Who are your mentors in the food community?
In Charleston, there's a few guys, Frank Lee and Donald Berrickman, that have been around for a while. They've opened the early restaurants, which are 20 years old now.
Very, very good. Well, you've been on before, and we always love having you on when you're doing a big event or, when you're in the city. So, thanks so much for coming and talking about what you do. Thanks to Michael Pollan for coming on. He was definitely, Jack, would you go so far as to say it was in the top 50 percentile of interviews we've ever done here?
In all seriousness, I'd have to say that was a top 5 interview, and you did a great job.
Top 5%?
Top 5%.
Wow. Yeah, sure.
And I, Twitter's a little bit outraged. The beer guys are kind of losing it. Their question wasn't answered, but I had to tell Jimmy. Michael ran out of time. We'll have to get to it next time.
Another question was not answered was Sam Edwards' question about nitrates in hams. Uh-huh. And when I heard Michael, did you hear him at one point? And he was like, "Honey, I'm on the radio." That was 5 minutes after I told him we would be done.
Exactly.
And we went on another 5 after that.
So I get a good feeling he'll be back, though.
Yes, definitely. So, Jack, great job. Who's on the next show, Straight No Chaser?
Straight No Chaser with Katie Kiefer.
And do you know who her guest is?
Sam Fromarts.
Well, enough said. That's a household name. And then the next show is, what's after that? Morning After, followed by Burning Down the House.
Mike and Judy, too.
Oh,
at 2
Mike
o'clock.
And Judy, man.
And this is our last show until 2012, so see you in the new year.
Yeah, sounds good.